Hello and welcome back to the MJA podcast. My name is Kate Swanell and I'm the Journal's news and online editor. Our topic today is stroke medicine and specifically the advances that have been made in the past decade to radically improve outcomes for patients. Professor Bruce Campbell is the head of stroke at Royal Melbourne Hospital. He has written a narrative review published in the MJA and he is my special guest today. It's an exciting time, isn't it, in stroke treatment?
It has really been an exciting few years, particularly. Thrombolysis for 20 years, yes. More than that now, and we've had clot retrieval come along in 2015 and really transform outcomes for patients with the most severe ischemic strokes. And we're really looking forward, hopefully, in the years to come to having a better treatment for intracerebral hemorrhage. That's really where we're lacking good treatments at the moment.
What's the prevalence of AIS at the moment in Australia? Do we know?
There's about 55,000 new strokes every year.
Okay.
And the majority are ischemic.
Is that a trend that's going up or down?
In Australia, it's in developed countries, it's reasonably static. In the developing world, it's still increasing. So there's dietary changes, air pollution, all sorts of factors in the developing world, which are driving an increase in stroke. And obviously, as the population ages, the absolute number of strokes increases as well. But at a sort of an age-adjusted level, it's become fairly static.
Let's talk reperfusion therapy. What is it and how has it changed care?
Reperfusion is all about restoring blood flow to the brain. So with ischemic stroke, the key is that there is a blocked vessel somewhere in the piping that supplies the brain. And to get that open, you either need a clot-dissolving medicine, which is thrombolysis, or you need the thrombectomy, which is going in with an angiogram and someone physically removing the clot.
How has it changed the way people survive stroke and how has it changed the disability burden down the line?
So if you talk about thrombolysis for a start, it's applicable to maybe 20% of all patients with an ischemic stroke. We're hoping that will increase because there's recent data that shows you can extend beyond our traditional 4.5-hour barrier using advanced brain imaging. So we might be able to get more than that. At the moment in Australia, 13% of people across the country get thrombolysis. The most active centres, as I said, are around 20%. So there's still room to improve the proportion of patients getting thrombolysis. And then with thrombectomy, maybe about 10% of all ischemic stroke patients can be eligible for that. You need a large blocked vessel. The devices certainly at the moment don't go out into very small vessels. So It's really the carotid artery, the first part of the middle cerebral artery where it's a relatively large vessel is accessible. Mm-hmm. And although that might sound like not very many patients, 10%, it is the group of patients who have the highest risk of disability and death. It makes a big impact on the disability burden.
So what are the barriers to accessing reperfusion therapy? Is it all about geography or are there other barriers as well?
There's lots of barriers, unfortunately, and it goes right across the spectrum. So the first thing is that the patient or the person around them needs to recognise it's a stroke. Without that, you don't quit a 000 call, you don't get all the systems activated. So people need to be able to recognise stroke in the community. We have the FAST campaign. Yes. Every time there's a TV campaign with a FAST message, the awareness goes up for a few months and then it starts to drift down again. So we need to be constantly battering the community recognition of stroke.
FAST as in facial droop. Arm weakness,
slurred
speech, yes.
And time to call 000. Perfect. You've got the message. Well done. So we want people to recognise that obviously there are lots of other symptoms of stroke, but most people with a significant stroke will have one of the face drooping, the arm being weak or the leg and some sort of slurred or incomprehensible speech. So it's a good memory aid to say that something terrible is going on in that person's brain.
All right. So step one is recognise what's happening.
Step two is get them to hospital. So we have, skilled paramedics in Australia, fortunately, who are pretty good at recognising stroke. They have tools to recognise stroke and they can take people to the appropriate hospital. Mm-hmm. We're working to improve that. So there's moves afoot to have recognition of severe stroke patients that might need an endovascular thrombectomy. So that's not available at all hospitals. So hopefully in the future we'll be able to bypass those severe stroke patients directly to a hospital that can manage those sort of treatments. It's already happening in Western Australia. They've applied a tool called RACE, which was developed in Spain or in Catalonia, to identify severe stroke patients and bypass them straight to an endovascular capable hospital. And there's moves afoot in other states to do similar things. And there's also interventions like a mobile stroke unit. So this is very exciting for us. We get to go around in an ambulance with a CT scanner, go to the person's house, diagnose and treat them right there on the footpath, which is obviously making a huge difference in time. And every minute counts in stroke. So we know, certainly with thrombectomy, it's incredibly time sensitive. Every 4 minutes that goes by, one in 100 patients has a worse outcome. So, and thrombolysis is the same. Every minute really does count. So getting out there in the community, the pre-hospital time has really become the biggest chunk of delay between onset and treatment now. The in-hospital processes are starting to get a bit better.
Good. Tell us about those in-hospital processes. You dedicate a bit of your review to how, once a patient has arrived, how things can be made faster for a stroke patient.
Yeah, and it's really all about preparing. Mm. So having an ambulance pre-notification that you're getting a suspected stroke patient helps. The team can meet them at the triage desk and ideally go direct to the CT scanner, because that really is our rate-limiting step. Without CT, we can't tell if it's a bleed or a blocked vessel.
Yep.
We don't know whether the stroke's already done what it's going to do or if there's still salvageable brain tissue. And so we want to go straight from triage to CT, get all the imaging done, and then make a decision about treatment. And that may involve transfer out to another hospital if you need a thrombectomy and it's not available on site.
How expensive are mobile stroke units, and how many are there, and how do you get them, more of them?
There's about 30 around the world currently, mostly in North America and Europe. Berlin is one of the pioneering sites that has three mobile stroke units in Berlin, which pretty much covers the entire city 24/7. Yeah. But in most places, it's a business hour service. So we have one in Australia, in Melbourne, and it covers about a 20-kilometre radius from the Royal Melbourne, and then goes out a bit further to rendezvous with paramedic crews that request us. So it's roughly $1 million capital investment, and then about that much in staffing every year. So it's an expensive investment, but the ability to reduce the time to treatment is likely to make it cost effective, because stroke is such a costly disease for our community.
Is there a cost benefit analysis in the works?
It's in the works, yes. Yeah.
How important is it to have a specialised stroke unit?
It's the basis of everything we do. So just having a concentrated expertise of doctors, nursing staff, allied health professionals who are all interested in stroke and have experience with stroke reduces death and disability. And the great thing about it is it works for all types of stroke patients, so whether it's bleeding or ischemic stroke, and whether it's young, old, severe, mild. So, that is the basis on which everything else is built, and you can't do good thrombolysis and good thrombectomy and all those other things if you don't have a basic stroke unit to build it all on.
Yeah.
So we've done reasonably well in Australia. Most patients would have a stroke unit in the vicinity, and it's a matter of making sure that they get there and that they spend the majority of their time in hospital in a stroke unit, because unfortunately, when we audit these things for the Stroke Foundation, a lot of people only spend a small percentage of their time on the stroke unit or never make it there.
If I'm a farmer in Western New South Wales and I go down with a stroke, depending on which bit of Western New South Wales I'm in, how much time do you think is there available in which to have a beneficial effect?
Well, that's where, we're really trying to build the telemedicine capacity. So in Victoria, we're fortunate we've got a very good coverage with 17 rural sites with telemedicine, and there have been recent political announcements that that's going to be funded to become a more nationwide, particularly New South Wales, phenomenon. So with that kind of technology, you can bring the city stroke expert into the small rural hospital. You can see the imaging. The imaging is actually possible to do in the smaller hospitals in most cases.
Yep.
And you can make an accurate diagnosis, start treatment. And with these imaging-based time windows, people in far-flung parts of Australia can actually get flown in if they've got appropriate imaging. So if you're lucky and you've got good collaterals, which is the natural bypass vessels that keeps tissue alive, then you can have a four-hour fixed-wing flight from rural New South Wales or rural Queensland into one of the big centres and still get a good outcome for some of these patients. Obviously, there are some who are going to miss out. It's not impossible as it used to be. There's light at the end of the tunnel there.
Tell us a little bit about the Extend trial.
So Extend is a trial run by Steve Davis, Jeff Donnan in Australia, New Zealand, Taiwan and Finland, which showed that you can improve outcomes with thrombolysis beyond 4.5 hours if you have good imaging. And that's, again, using something like CT perfusion or MRI, if you can get access to that, mm-hmm. that shows that you've got a relatively small area of irreversibly damaged brain and a much larger area that's potentially going to spring back to life if you open the artery. So that's been presented at a couple of conferences, and the paper will come out relatively shortly. And that's something that will become standard practice over time. It's not entered guidelines yet, obviously.
I'm chatting today with Bruce Campbell, professorial fellow at the University of Melbourne and the head of stroke medicine at Royal Melbourne Hospital. His narrative review is available at mja.com.au, as are all of our podcasts. Or you can subscribe for free to our iTunes feed. Back to our chat. Is that one of the most exciting areas of research? Are there others that are also on the horizon?
I think we've seen this happen with thrombectomy last year, that the window was expanded from 6 hours to 24 hours using the same principle of imaging selection to identify salvageable brain tissue. You know, there's lots of frontiers in stroke still. We need to get the systems right. We need to continue to expand our understanding of who can benefit, because these reperfusion therapies are very powerful, and we probably still haven't expanded to the limits of what we can achieve. And there'll be technological advances as well. I mentioned that thrombectomy at the moment is limited to big arteries, but no doubt the devices will become smaller arteries in the future. Now, I mentioned earlier that hemorrhage is really something that we want to focus more attention on. There's potential with hemostatic agents. So tranexamic acid's been studied. It works in trauma. We haven't had a positive trial in intracerebral hemorrhage yet, but there's still a lot of interest and feeling that if we can get it in early enough, then it may benefit patients by slowing down and stopping the bleeding. And that's one of the areas where the mobile stroke unit's a very interesting place to be, because you get patients so much earlier than you otherwise would. Yeah. And there's also potential for surgery. So, for instance, our group's interested in doing a trial of surgical evacuation. It's been done before and not been successful. We think we can change that paradigm a little with different techniques. And again, a super early approach, we think, is key to that.
It's time, isn't it? Time is it. Just get in there as fast as you can. Yeah.
Yeah. Both hemorrhage and ischemic stroke are rapidly progressive conditions that kill brain cells. So if you want to prevent disability, you've got to get in quick and stop that process.
What is cytoprotection, and how can we improve it or make it viable?
So cytoprotection is the new preferred term for what we used to call neuroprotection, which has got a bad reputation. So neuroprotection is trying to save neurons, not by restoring blood flow, but by preventing all the nasty chemical changes that happen and cause the cell to die.
Okay.
And that's been tested in many, many trials. There are literally hundreds of compounds that save brain cells in rats, and none of them have been translated successfully to humans yet. So one of the problems is the way that animal science was done, but one of the problems is also in humans, we haven't had treatments that reliably open the artery every time. Okay. And so with thrombectomy, we hope that we have converted some of the human stroke into what they do in rats, which is a temporary occlusion of the middle cerebral artery. So if you have that kind of model and you have some of the drugs that have been properly tested in animal models, hopefully that will translate to benefit. And there's one trial led from Canada, which is getting very close to finish. And I think early next year we'll find out if that paradigm is going to work or not. But there's been a bit of a resurgence of interest in cytoprotection, recognising it's not just the brain cells you need to save, it's all the supporting glial cells and the vascular cells that you need to save as well.
So, it really is, like we say, it's an exciting time in whatever research, but it really, really is in stroke, isn't it? I mean, things are literally happening every year.
It is, and I'm very fortunate that, you know, in Australia we have this living guidelines process now where we can update our treatment guidelines as it happens, which, last one was 2010 and we had a big gap to 2017, and now we're just starting this process, which is really a world first, of having regular updates. As research comes to publication, we'll evaluate it and we'll be able to change our recommendations and hopefully reduce that lag time, because we've seen in medicine time and time again that you have the data and then practice doesn't change for sometimes decades, which is very frustrating.
Yeah.
So we're trying to shorten that translation cycle.
Apart from winning a big lotto win and having a few more mobile stroke units, if you could wave your magic wand, Bruce, what would you change right now to improve outcomes for stroke patients?
I think it comes back to that system element. You know, we need the community to recognise stroke. And so anyone listening to this, make sure your friends and relatives and your broader community know that FAST message.
Yep.
I think we can do a lot more in the pre-hospital space. I think it's highly likely that we will find in the Australian context that mobile stroke units actually are an effective and cost-effective way of doing things in the big cities. For rural patients, we'll need different approaches. And I think the telemedicine really is the key to trying to narrow that rural metro divide in quality of care.
Once a patient's had their stroke and has been treated and is on the road to recovery, how important is secondary prevention?
Absolutely essential. So if you've had one stroke, unfortunately, you obviously have risk factors to have another one.
Mm-hmm.
And we're getting better at determining the mechanisms of stroke.
Yep.
Peyton Frayman of Ali is one I emphasised in the review that until the last couple of years has been incredibly controversial as whether it really was a cause of stroke or not. And I think we now have the definitive evidence that in young people with no other cause of stroke, you find a PFO, that's likely to be the cause, even though one in four of us will have a PFO out in the community. It's certainly is a risk factor for stroke, and closing it, which you can do via an angiogram, so fairly minimally invasive, reduces the risk. It's 1% reduction per annum, which doesn't sound like lots, but it seems to be a cumulative year-on-year reduction. So for these young people in 20 years, that's probably a 20% reduction in stroke, which is really obviously a huge thing. The basics, you know, the blood pressure control, not smoking, getting the sugars under control and diabetes, all those things are absolutely critical. We use high-potency statins in stroke prevention. We have more recent evidence for using combined antiplatelets, so aspirin plus clopidogrel, just for the short term. So it's a bit unlike cardiology where you see people have a stent and then they're on aspirin and clopidogrel for a long period of time. In stroke, probably because our patients tend to be a little bit older and frailer, that tends to increase bleeding more than it saves stroke. But just for that first 3 weeks or so, having aspirin and clopidogrel together does reduce the risk of another stroke. So that's worthwhile doing and knowing about.
Is there anything new on the horizon for patients with AF?
AF is a real epidemic in our community.
It really
it's partly
is.
About people surviving their heart disease, having long-standing hypertension, living longer. I mean, age is the biggest risk factor. And every day I see someone who's had a massive, devastating stroke because either they weren't known to have AF or they had it and people didn't anticoagulate either enough or properly, or they stopped it for a procedure. So, yeah, the management of AF is a huge problem for us. And also in the patients where we haven't identified a cause, you know, if you've had a big blocked vessel stroke that we've clot retrieved, if the carotid artery is pristine and doesn't have atherosclerosis in it, we're very suspicious that patient's got AF and we'll monitor in hospital and we'll do a Holter monitor 24 hours. But the data really show that you probably should monitor people for months. And if you monitor people for 3 years with an implantable loop recorder, you'll find about 20% of them, maybe 30% of them have AF. And I guess if you have a little bit of AF 3 years after the stroke, you wonder about whether that was the cause, but it's still a risk factor of having another one. So we are taking that a lot more seriously in the long-term monitoring, but just, you know, for the general practitioners out there, it's really important to find AF, feel the pulse every time you see the patients, particularly the older ones who've had long-standing hypertension. And if they meet the criteria for anticoagulation, which is pretty simple, really, I mean, you do a CHADS-BAS score, and if you've got more than 1 point for a non-gender-related problem, then you should be anticoagulated, and this is a very good reason not to. And we see too much use of the lower dose of the anticoagulant. So, you know, you've got a choice between 110 milligrams or 150 milligrams twice a day of dabigatran or 5 milligrams or 2.5 of apixaban or 20 of rivaroxaban or 15. And people, unfortunately, often go for the lower dose not appropriately. So underdosed, you see, we had a patient today who came in taking their anticoagulation once a day when it should be twice a day, and they had a big stroke. So this kind of improvised management of anticoagulation is something we've really got to work on. It's a discussion I often have with patients because in Australia, you know, for instance, with the dabigatran, we reduce the dose at age 75, but in Europe, they reduce it when you get to age 80, and in America, they never reduce it based on age.
Huh.
So these things are all a risk-benefit calculation, but we certainly don't do our best by the patients when we deliberately underdose. It's a misguided sense that we're trying to reduce the risk, and it's usually not worth it.
So is there a message about stroke and stroke prevention for GPs that we can easily synthesise down from your review? Bruce?
It really comes down to the basics. You need really good intensive blood pressure control. We don't accept 145 systolic as good enough. You want it consistently under 140, and I think the data on this will strengthen that it probably is. We probably need to be targeting more like 120 like we do for other cardiovascular conditions.
Right.
Just the SPRINT trial that specifically showed 120 was better than 140 excluded stroke patients, so I can't put my hand on my heart and say there's strong evidence for stroke specifically, but certainly 120 versus 140 in people with cardiovascular disease reduce the risk of stroke, and blood pressure is the biggest risk factor for both an intracerebral hemorrhage and ischemic stroke. And so it's incredibly sensitive to even small 4 or 5 millimeter systolic reductions in blood pressure. So we've got to get blood pressure right and not accept that, you know, mild high blood pressure is good enough. The antiplatelet side of things, I mentioned the early dual antiplatelets and then just getting back to single antiplatelets, the high potency statins. Yes, some people do get myalgias, but we need to at least try to use a high potency, high dose statin, and then we can back off if they really can't tolerate it. And then obviously the smoking cessation, the exercise, all the basic stuff that we have trouble motivating people to change their behaviour, but it's critical to keep dripping water on the stone. But you're right, it is an exciting time, and I hope that we'll see lots more developments in both in the systems and also in the treatments over the next few years.
Thanks for your time, Bruce.
Pleasure. Thanks, Kate.
My thanks to my special guest today. Don't forget that all our podcasts are open access and available at www.mja.com.au/podcasts. Or you can subscribe to our feed at iTunes. My name's Kate Swanell, and we'll see you next time.